This is the Healing Podcast brought to you by Marin Health. I'm Bill Klaproth, and with me is Dr. Anjali Brighton, pulmonology and sleep medicine physician at Marin Health Critical Care and Pulmonology, a UCSF health clinic. Dr. Brighton, welcome.
Thank you so much, Bill. It's great to be here.
And great to talk with you. So let's start with this. Can you explain to us what exactly is obstructive sleep apnea and how common is it?
Obstructive sleep apnea is a term we use for a condition that affects breathing during sleep. And what it refers to are blockages that affect the upper airway, in effect making it so that a person has stopped breathing events while they are trying to rest. And this can cause drops in oxygen and have impacts on all the other organs in the system because of that airway blockage, leading to impaired breathing.
So we hear a lot about snoring, like that is a telltale sign of sleep apnea, but when is snoring just an annoyance? And then when is it a red flag for sleep apnea?
This is a great question because snoring is considered a symptom that likely increases the likelihood of obstructive sleep apnea being there. And we do think this is a very common condition. We think worldwide there's probably more than 900 million people who have obstructive sleep apnea. Snoring can also be, the absence of snoring can reduce the likelihood that obstructive sleep apnea is there. But there is also a condition that we refer to as just primary snoring, where a person can be tested and found that they don't have obstructive sleep apnea, but they do develop these sounds during sleep, which are generated, we think, because the airway is narrowing partially, and as the air is turbulent, passing through from outside into the back of the throat and then into the lungs, the tissues there start to vibrate and result in snoring.
So is it fair to say for someone who snores, is a regular snorer, they probably should get checked for sleep apnea just to make sure?
Absolutely. It's so valuable to get it evaluated only because sleep apnea is a condition that really is tied into cardiovascular conditions, neurological health, and you've only got a lot to gain by getting evaluated.
Yeah, that is true. So then who is most at risk for developing sleep apnea? It seems like it can strike anyone. Are there lifestyle or genetic factors that play a role?
Yes, it can affect anyone, including children, but we usually think that older adults and males are more at risk for the condition. And that changes for women, though, as they reach perimenopause and after menopause, their risk increases almost equivalent to those of men. And other lifestyle factors that can impact sleep apnea would be alcohol intake. Alcohol acts as a muscle relaxant for the airway, and so it can increase those stop breathing events when someone is sleeping. We also think smoking is linked to higher rates of obstructive sleep apnea. And then genetic factors definitely play a role. We often feel that we inherit the shape of our airway from our parents, and there are certain craniofacial structural abnormalities that can also increase our risk.
Absolutely. So you said older adults and males are more likely to have sleep apnea, but again, it really can affect anyone. So earlier we were talking about snoring. What are some surprising, maybe, or lesser known symptoms people should look out for?
This is another great question because this really is a disorder that a lot of people would not have knowledge that they have symptoms of because sleep apnea can be silent. Although we may have snoring, the actual events themselves don't have large indicators. And so we think as much as a third of patients may actually present with insomnia, which is difficulty sleeping. And usually with sleep apnea, it's difficulty maintaining sleep. And so a person may have a lot of interrupted events during sleep or kind of wake up frequently during sleep. And this can be a clue that something is irritating to the body, resulting in lack of restful sleep. We also think that some patients have frequent urination as a main symptom of sleep apnea. Morning headaches can be another rarer symptom, but can be a clue that something is affecting that exchange of carbon dioxide during sleep and leading to headaches. And then we also find that there can be subtle symptoms. So difficult to control blood pressure could be another clue that a person could benefit from being evaluated.
So would that be someone with high blood pressure then? Is that what you're saying?
That's right. High blood pressure, especially if they're doing their best to change their lifestyle factors or they've even started medication and are still having trouble getting to those blood pressure goals.
So really good to know what you just said, Dr. Brighton. So if someone is waking up with morning headaches, that could also be a sign. You might not think sleep apnea, but that could be a sign. Having to go to the washroom frequently in the middle of the night, that's another one too. So thank you for sharing those lesser known symptoms. So if someone says, yeah, I don't snore, but man, I wake up with a headache every morning. Maybe they suspect they have sleep apnea. What does the diagnostic process look like? We hear about sleep studies all the time. Is a sleep study always required?
Yes, we do always need a sleep study because we rely on that study to count for us how many times a person experiences these apneas or stop breathing events when they're sleeping. And to make the diagnosis, we would need to see at a minimum 5 episodes happening each hour. And we come to that number by looking at all the events that they have during their sleep and averaging it over the number of hours that we observe them sleeping. But it can help us define how severe the condition is. Is it on the milder side, more moderate, or severe? And this often helps us choose the right treatment. But we have options in how we can diagnose it. The traditional way is to do a sleep study in a sleep laboratory, and this allows us to do very intensive monitoring. There is always a sleep technician with you during that night who is actually observing these events as they occur, marking them, and helping us diagnose how severe the condition is. It involves EEG monitoring, EMG monitoring, we have an EKG as well, and all together with your heart rate, oxygen, and other parameters, we come to a consensus about whether the condition is there and how severe it might be. But a more modern way of testing that has emerged is home sleep apnea testing. And a lot of patients find this more appealing. We do think there are some advantages to the home testing. We do lose some data, so home testing is much simpler. We go from about 20, 30 different monitors in a sleep lab session to about somewhere between 2 to 6 monitors with a home sleep apnea kit. But the advantages are that we probably get a more realistic view of a typical night of sleep for each patient when they do it at home. And it's a lot easier to self-administer that test, and we still gain really useful data, especially if our main concern is obstructive sleep apnea.
I can see where that home testing would be a very desirable, like you said, less intrusive. You don't have to go to the sleep center. And I think it's good, as you say, if your dog jumps into bed every night at midnight, you're not going to know that when you're at the sleep center. So obviously there are advantages and disadvantages to both, but good to know that a sleep study really is the best way to diagnose the issues. So we've all heard of CPAP. We know this. We see the commercials. We probably all know someone that has a CPAP. That is the treatment that most people know best. But for those less familiar or might just be checking into sleep apnea, the fear they might have this and are learning about CPAP, can you share a little about what that looks like and the results and how it works and all of that?
Sure. CPAP stands for continuous positive airway pressure, and it is a device that will take the air around us but pressurize it and then deliver it to a person's airway through a mask. And this mask could be a nasal mask, which is usually a lot smaller and more minimalistic style mask, or there can be kind of these hybrid masks that use nasal and oral connections to bring that air into the body. It effectively acts as a stent for the airway so that no matter what sleep position a person is in, no matter how many apneas they are having, no matter what sleep stage they're in, because sleep apneas can worsen in deep stages of sleep, like REM sleep, for example, no matter what is happening, that machine is able to stent the airway open and allow that person to breathe just as comfortably as they can during the day when they are awake. The CPAP devices are very customizable, and they are still our preferred way to treat obstructive sleep apnea only because it is so highly effective of a therapy. It has instant results. The night that you start wearing it is the night it starts working to stop these episodes from happening. And we have good evidence showing that a CPAP reduces the severity of sleep apnea events. We know that it is seen as a way to reduce excessive sleepiness, which is a very common symptom in obstructive sleep apnea, often because the sleep we are getting is not restorative, is not of good quality, because the body is on alert every time we have a stop breathing event. We also think we have evidence that CPAP and suppressing those apnea episodes can improve blood pressure control, as we talked about earlier. And there's even some evidence that it can help with blood sugar control, and as well, emotional well-being is thought to benefit.
So it really is the gold standard as we know it.
Absolutely.
But knowing that, many people struggle to adapt to CPAP or feel embarrassed about using it, right? So what strategies do you recommend to improve comfort and consistency with treatment?
Yeah, it absolutely is something that we need the healthcare team to help all our patients with, improving the comfort and tolerability of CPAP, and really the mask interface is really key. And almost every sleep physician will always prioritize that, knowing that if we get the mask right, meaning we choose the appropriate size and the most comfortable version of it for each person, that the odds are that we can get CPAP to be accepted by the body and it becomes more of a friend and a helper than this irritation. It is important that we also help choose pressure settings that are well tolerated by patients. These days, the machines are smart machines. They can adjust for each patient during the night, meaning that the pressures can start off very low and then increase if needed. If apnea events continue to happen, the machine is smart enough to adjust the pressures. At the same time, we've learned that some people don't respond well to that automatic adjustment, and they seem to prefer it when we just set a fixed pressure setting for them. And these are things that sleep doctors will help personalize for each patient to try to make it more comfortable. The other thing that can help is making sure that we help refresh supplies. Unfortunately, these masks, the seal can be lost with use. As the silicone wears down, then we start getting lots of leaking. And this can be very irritating when you're trying to sleep and feeling this rush of air through the sides of the face or towards the eyes. And so replacing equipment can be valuable. And then I'll often ask patients to try CPAP when they first get it, especially try it while you're awake. You won't harm yourself by wearing this machine when you're awake. And what it does by doing that, let's say you're watching your favorite TV show, you've got your favorite book in front of you, you're going to be trying to distract yourself as you get used to this brand new therapy. By doing that during the day for 5 or 10 minutes, you're helping the body accept this new therapy, kind of desensitize yourself to it. And then when you go to wear it at night, it becomes easier to tolerate.
Yeah, that's really good information about CPAP. And again, like I said, it is the gold standard. But can you talk about other effective options that exist today?
Absolutely. You know, we're learning more and more that we really need to personalize care to each patient, and not everyone adapts well to CPAP. And we have a great resource in our colleagues in dentistry. So there are dentists who have additional sleep medicine expertise, and they can often create a device that we call a mandibular advancement device, or commonly referred to as an MAD. And this is a device that is almost like wearing a retainer or a mouth guard like you might wear for dentition or for jaw clenching or teeth grinding, except that it is made to change the position of the lower jaw, move it forward by a few millimeters. And just by doing this, we often can move the tongue forward and create more space at the back of the airway so that when that person goes to sleep, their muscles relax and the airway is going to collapse. Having this mandibular advancement device in place will protect them from having to experience that. We think the efficacy of these is somewhere around 60 to 70%, and there's been a lot of new updates with these devices, so it's another great option for patients. Another set of options can come from surgery, and we often rely on our ear, nose, and throat surgery colleagues for assistance in this area. Sometimes they can do surgeries that affect the anatomy of the upper airway. And one of the newest forms of treatment that have come out also involving surgery is something called a hypoglossal nerve stimulator. And this can be used to treat apnea that does not respond to CPAP or the patient finds CPAP difficult to tolerate. Another new therapy that is being evaluated is Zepbound or tirzepatide, which is one of the medications used to help with weight loss. And there is some evidence that in helping with weight loss, it will help reduce the number of apneas a person experiences.
Really interesting stuff, the new options to treat sleep apnea today. The second surgical procedure you mentioned, is that what is known as Inspire?
That's correct, Bill.
Okay, because we do see those commercials on TV, and I bet for some people that can't deal with the hose and the mask and all that stuff, it is an interesting option, as well as the other options that you mentioned. I want to ask you about something. There's a TikTok trend where people are taping their mouths shut to stop snoring in an attempt to help sleep apnea. Is that a thing?
It is a very prominent social media trend that we are seeing, and we as sleep doctors, our sleep community feels like there is actually more harm than good that can come from mouth taping. We do worry that it potentially, especially if it is a very tight seal that is formed, that it may actually increase the risk of airway obstruction. We also worry, for example, if someone has nasal obstruction, so they're not able to breathe through their nose, they have congestion, something has changed, and then they have tape over the mouth, it is just not a good way to ensure safety with breathing. There is some evidence that it may help people who wear CPAP and experience a lot of leak through their mouth. And this predominantly happens if they're using a nasal CPAP mask and their mouth is unintentionally opening during the night. But we still don't feel like it is a valid therapy, and it definitely has not been studied in clinical trials the way the remainder of our therapies have. So for most of our patients, we would strongly encourage them not to follow those trends. Talk about it with your doctors and see if there's another option that may help you.
Yes, absolutely. The best way to go about that. I saw that and went, okay, taping your mouth shut? No. So Dr. Brighton, we often hear about weight and sleep apnea. They often get mentioned together. So how does body weight influence the condition? And does treating sleep apnea help with weight control?
Weight and sleep apnea are definitely linked in that we have seen that when a person loses weight, and we think somewhere between 10 to 15% of their weight, we think we can see decreases in their apnea events, or their apnea hypopnea index will fall. At the same time, we have also seen many patients who get to their goal weight, they feel great, and then we end up retesting to see, has their sleep apnea resolved? Do they still need CPAP? And sometimes the sleep apnea does go into remission or seemingly resolve. Other times, though, we will test and there will still be a component of sleep apnea. And we think this is because weight is thought to increase the amount of soft tissue around the airway. And so if a person loses weight, we would expect that amount of soft tissue to decrease, which should theoretically allow for more space in the airway and give less risk of collapse as the person is sleeping. But there are so many other anatomical factors that can still result in sleep apnea being there, tongue position, sleep state. So it is linked. We do think it is a valuable strategy, but it is often a strategy that we need in combination with another treatment. And we know that good weight loss is done over a prolonged period of time. We want that weight loss to be gradual and measured. And sleep apnea often needs treatment right away. So a combination of CPAP and efforts to optimize weight can be good. It is a little controversial as there is data that showed that people who wore CPAP seemingly gained weight after they started treatment or their BMI increased. Overall, though, we think most studies show that we can decrease the severity of sleep apnea by improving weight.
Okay, well, that is good to know. So then what are the risks of leaving sleep apnea untreated? How does it affect heart health, mood, and overall quality of life?
The effects of untreated sleep apnea is often what your sleep doctors are most concerned about, and a lot of your primary care doctors, cardiologists, and neurologists will be worried about. We have seen that sleep apnea is a risk factor for developing many heart conditions. So this includes everything from atrial fibrillation, high blood pressure, as we mentioned, heart attack as well. And then if we expand to the neurological system, we know sleep apnea is a risk factor for stroke as well. We also think we have seen that people with anxiety or depression may experience an improvement in their mood by treating sleep apnea. And similarly, for quality of life, the impacts can be huge. We think there are likely effects on focus, concentration, memory, and one of the other most important impacts of sleep apnea as it causes excessive daytime sleepiness is it increases risks of car accidents or crashes. And so we are often very keen to treat because we would like to reduce risk for all of those conditions.
Wow, that's a lot of stuff, Dr. Brighton.
Yes.
Holy cow. So it really does affect a lot of things and a lot of vital functions in your body. So it is something not to just, I'm not going to worry about it. It is something really to get checked. So for listeners who want to take action now, which it sounds like they should, do you have any simple suggestions on how to improve breathing at night besides making sure they make an appointment with a sleep specialist?
We do think that avoiding sleeping on our back or supine sleeping can be protective. It has to do with anatomy again and the effects of gravity on the airway. When we sleep on our back, there's a higher likelihood that our tongue will fall backward into the airway and create obstruction, create apneas for us. So simply trying to train yourself or using pillows or other aids to encourage side sleeping can be beneficial. And then reducing alcohol intake can be beneficial too. Alcohol acts as a muscle relaxant for the muscles around the airway, and reducing or eliminating that can reduce the severity of these apnea events. Stopping smoking is always valuable as well. We think that staying active is also a protective strategy, so including daily physical activity is beneficial. And then the other thing that may be easy to overlook but is valuable to treat is if you're experiencing a lot of nasal congestion related to allergies, recurrent sinus infections, or anatomical challenges, it's worthwhile getting that evaluated as well because that will help your nighttime breathing.
Really good thoughts, Dr. Brighton. Sleep on your side, reduce alcohol. If you smoke, stop smoking, stay active. And then nasal congestion, very interesting. This has really been fantastic, Dr. Brighton. A lot of great information on a condition that I know affects a lot of people. Thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Bill. It was a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. And once again, that is Dr. Anjali Brighton. And for more information, go to mymarinhealth.org. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please share it on your social channels and check out the entire podcast library for topics of interest to you. I'm Bill Klaproth. This is the Healing Podcast, brought to you by Marin Health. Thanks for listening.